Today is Friday, November 11, 11, 11, 11. And we're in chapter 15, going soon to be in 16. Chapter 15, of course, deals with carbohydrate metabolism. And we have another couple chapters of that, then we get on with the rest of it. Hopefully when we get the lipid metabolism, I typically bring a bunch of Oreo cookies for breakfast. That's good eating. But we will wait for that pretty soon. And any prayer requests this morning at all? People going well, doing well, things going well so far? Okay. Well, good. I know we have Sabbath coming up, and it'll be a great time to take a break from the grind of the week. It's been a bad week. Has it been a bad week for you guys? Not too bad? A bad week for me. But, at any rate, and as you can tell, I'm way behind on grading your tests. They will be done on Monday. And I apologize for being so far behind. Did anybody see my poster at the research celebration? Anybody go to the research celebration? No? Anyway, mine was up in the far corner, about as far away from the actual celebration as you could get. So, but it actually had real data on it. That's kind of fun. And data that actually is significant for pancreatic cancer. We're going to post it in the, post it in the department somewhere, and maybe you can take a look at it and I'll describe it to you. So it's all good. Let's pray, shall we? Dear Lord, thank you again for every breath we take. Thank you for the marvelous creation you've made. Thank you also for the sentient beings we are, that we can understand how we are made. But Lord, we cannot discover why we were made by examining how we were made. We have to understand why we were made by listening to you and reading what you told us as to why we were made and why we were here and what purpose we are. And Lord, we ask during these next 24 hours that begin and end with the Sabbath that we may re-examine and rejoice again as to why we are made. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, I think I'm going to leave. Oh, good night. What's going on with that? What's going on with that middle one anyway? It's way out of focus. Okay, well, for those of you who apparently, you know, who have very good eyes, we take a look at the middle one, but otherwise we'll have to take a look at all these others. What is the Pasteur effect, ladies and gentlemen? What is the Pasteur effect? What's it say that it is? Yes, exactly. He didn't say it very loud, but that's exactly right. It's the effect that occurs when organisms are forced to survive on glucose. Without oxygen, the rate of glucose consumption rises dramatically. And now we know, he didn't know at the time why, but now we do. Now we do. There was an explosion. The history of metabolic, understanding metabolic pathways begins after World War II. When during World War II, so much research was done for the war effort on radioactive elements. And it was realized that we could track radioactive elements pretty easily. And when they discovered that, they put those radioactive elements in the substrates for all these chemical reactions, and they could follow the radioactivity through the cell. And that's how much of the early metabolism was discovered, was using radioactive elements, because of the horrible thing called World War II. Now, control of glycolysis, ladies and gentlemen. Here we have a graphic representation of it. And I want you to see where the largest drops in free energy are. That is occurring at reaction number 1, reaction number 3, and reaction number 10. Have we seen those enzymes before? Have we seen those enzymes before in terms of regulation? Where do we find that? If you go back to overhead number 5, look at overhead number 5, and you see where the enzymes that are under strictest control, the enzymes under strictest control are those that have the greatest free energy difference in them. And that is not an accident. That when there is that great energy, the great free energy difference between the substrates and the products, that's where it's easiest to control them. That's where the choke points are. That's where it's easiest to turn them on and off. Okay, and so that's where you make the statement here. Typically, most pathways, glycolysis is regulated at the enzymes that are far from equilibrium. That's a statement that you can take to the bank. If you see enzymes or mechanisms or pathways on standardized tests that you're not familiar with, and they purposely put them on there so you're not familiar with them, and then they ask you questions about general principle, this is one of the general principles that you need to recall, that enzymes and pathways are controlled at the points in which the enzyme is far, or the enzyme reaction is far from equilibrium. So that's a general principle. Circle it and remember it. All right, now we're going to look at some details. PFK regulation. As you know, PFK regulation, there are a lot of allosteric effectors. It is one of the interesting ones in which a particular material, a substrate, ATP, is also a regulatory molecule. You see here we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 blanks on this page. The first blank is tetrameric. Tetrameric with two states, inactive and active. Okay, then you next blank is twice, as I just mentioned earlier. The next blank is F26P, which we'll talk about today, I believe, I hope. And then inhibitor is the next blank. And the next blank is D-inhibit, and put capital D, capital E, inhibit. D-inhibit. And the fifth blank is PFK2, phosphofructokinase 2. And then the last blank is rapid. So let's take a look at what's going on here. The phosphofructokinase regulation has several interesting facts about it. When you look at the graph of the rate activity versus the its substrate concentration, what shape do you see the graph in? How would you describe the shape of the graph? Is it hyperbolic? It's hyperbolic perhaps for right here, perhaps right in that region. But what do you think about right in there, or perhaps even there? It's what? Sigmoidal. That immediately implies what complex behavior? Cooperativity. That's exactly correct. Cooperativity is not an examination we're going to look at, not a concept we're going to look at very strongly on this particular enzyme, but it does indicate cooperativity, and that's another concept that you can put in your long-term memory banks that you applies to virtually all enzymes. Sigmoidal shapes of the activity curve indicates cooperativity. It also typically indicates multiple subunit enzymes. There are rare exceptions, but there are exceptions. The vast majority of enzymes that display sigmoidal or cooperativity are multimeric. 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 26. 26, Dr. Dillett? Yes, 26 subunits that display cooperativity. And this particular enzyme is no exception. It's homotetrameric. There's four identical subunits on it. And it goes through the T inactive state just like hemoglobin. T, of course, is active and R is active. The ATP binds twice, once to the substrate, once to allosteric regularity. I mentioned that. Also binds ADP, AMP, and F26P, citric acid, and others as allosteric regulators. Wow. But notice here, this is the interesting thing. ATP alone is a strong inhibitor. Basically, it says that in the presence of ATP, the enzyme is turned off. and ADP, AMP, and F26P as allosteric regulators de-inhibit. That's because ATP will always be present. If there's no ATP in the cell, guess what the cell is? Dead. So this particular enzyme is always trying to be turned off, by ATP. So the presence of these other small regulatory molecules de-inhibit that aspect of it. Okay. The most important or powerful one, potent as it says here, is this small molecule called F26P. F26, fructose 2,6 bisphosphate. When I took biochemistry long ago, if you remember, of course, I didn't invent DIRT, but I was on the committee that named it. So when I was in college taking this same biochemistry class you did, the biochemistry textbook was about that thick and had no mention of F26P because it was discovered in 1976, the year I graduated from college. And that's why I'm going to start bringing wheelchairs here, because I am that old. Yes, I am that old. And so it was actually just in the literature about that. Odd that such a powerful and important inhibitor or regulatory enzyme, a regulatory allosteric modifier, pardon me, of that enzyme was discovered in 1976. I mean, you'd think it would have been discovered earlier. The reason why it wasn't was because it was difficult to detect. And they finally, of course, when they isolated PFK and they started working on it and they discovered, man, we're throwing all the molecules at it. We know, but it still isn't behaving properly. There must be something else. And they started looking for it and they found F26P. Okay. But interestingly enough, and we'll talk about the complex regulation of F26P in a little bit. Let's now take a look at this graph. Notice here that when there's cellular levels or approximately the cellular levels of ATP, notice where half Vmax is here. Notice where half Vmax, well, not half Vmax is. This is the normal concentration of fructose 6-phosphate, cellular concentration. And in the presence of one millimolar ATP, notice how low the activity of it is. And you have that same value of ATP, but you now add a tenth millimolar AMP, and suddenly the activity at that same fructose 6-phosphate concentration jumps up. And if you remove the inhibitors and remove the ATP, notice how active it is. So in three experiments, they verify that ATP is an inhibitor. You go from no inhibitors, low ATP, to one millimolar ATP, again with no inhibitors. Notice the huge drop in activity in the presence of ATP, and you then restore activity by adding back these other allosteric effectors. So this graph proves the statements that are up here. Now then, interesting, G is actually a transition to a new idea, a little bit of a different idea that's unique to PFK1. With ATP at maximum, that is maximally inhibited, the PFK rate is still too rapid for a cell at low metabolic activity. So if you're asleep and your liver is at low idle, and yet glycolysis is still going on, the problem that the body faces is that this PFK1 is still too rapid, even though it's been turned off maximally. There's still too much flux through that particular enzyme. All right, so okay. So this is a quote from here. We're going to go on and look at how the body solves this in a different way, as it were. But let's just read this quote directly from the text. The metabolic flux through glycolysis may vary by 100-fold or more, depending on the metabolic demand for ATP. However, measures of concentration of ATP in vivo at various levels of metabolic activity indicates ATP varies less than 10% between rest and vigorous exertion. So you have a 100-fold change in activity, but the ATP varies less than 10%. Therefore, a metabolic signal consisting of a decrease in ATP is too small to relieve PFK, I don't know where they got PRK, PFK inhibition, to is amplified significantly by a adenylate kinase reaction, which increases AMP by amount that produces a much larger increase in PFK activity. All right. So you can reduce the ATP. This is talking about you can reduce the ATP amount, but it doesn't turn on the enzyme enough. They add high levels of AMP that then begins to act on the enzyme to make it much more active. So there's a twofold effect when you're dealing with ATP and AMP. The ATP values will drop in a cell, but not enough to turn the enzyme on maximally. Therefore, while you have the ATP drop, which then reduces the inhibition, the small molecules concentration, such as AMP, rise dramatically, helping overcome the inhibition of ATP, thus increasing its activity. So this comment is talking about how you get such a great difference in flux between off and on. G here is talking about what happens when it's off and it's still too fast. Let's go ahead and take a look at the next line, next overhead. Okay, this is called the futile cycle. Now then, on here we see there are, let's take a look at it. Type in or write in futile. Then you have cycling, the next blank. Then reverses is the third blank. The fourth blank is net. So futile, cycling, reverses, net. Then underneath the diagram, this is overhead number 15, maximum is next blank. Reduced is the next blank, and 100-fold is the next blank. Wasting is the fourth blank underneath the figure. Fifth blank is 2. Sixth blank is excess. Seventh blank is fat. Next blank is non-shivering. 25 degrees is the next blank, and the last blank is cold. Next blank is cold. So you've got futile, cycling, reverses, net, maximum, reduced, 100, wasting, too much, excess, fat, non-shivering, 25 degrees, and cold. All right, so when this is off, it's still too fast. Interestingly, the PFK1 enzyme could be thought of as an enzyme whose minimum activity is still too high for a cell at rest. The cell effectively reduces the net flux to the enzyme using another enzyme which reverses the reaction. What enzyme reverses the fructose, the PFK1 activity? What enzyme is that? It's part of gluconeogenesis. What is the enzyme that is the opposite of PFK1 and is part of gluconeogenesis? Isn't it? What chapter was that in anyway? What chapter was gluconeogenesis in? Was that in this chapter? No. No, it wasn't 14. We haven't gone over gluconeogenesis, have we? Ah, that would account for it. We don't have gluconeogenesis in this one. It's okay. Let's go back. Okay, here we go. It's right here. It's the phosphatase. Fructose 1,6 bisphosphatase. There's two enzymes down here, one enzyme there and one enzyme up there. This is the phosphatase, fructose 1,6 bisphosphatase. That's the enzyme there that is reverse. And so this enzyme right here is fructose 1,6 bisphosphatase. It takes this FBP and makes it into fructose 6 phosphate, which is the beginning of it. So going down is a PFK1. Going back is that phosphatase. So at low cellular levels, the PFK1 activity is too high, so you're making too much FBP, which would go on down the glycolytic pathway, and we'll find out what happens to that. So what happens is there's a small amount of this activity still present, and it reverses it. That, of course, as you can imagine, is inefficient. Both are operating at the same time. This reduces the net flux through the enzyme. So the net flux, how much of this goes on, how much of this is made, is the net of this, the forward reaction and the reverse reaction. Under conditions of maximum activity, that's this one on your right, the reverse reaction is greatly reduced and the forward reaction is greatly increased, as you can see here, producing a whole 100-fold net increase in the flux. So you have an enzyme that turns on, an enzyme that turns off, and the amount of glucose, carbohydrate, going through that pathway is increased by 100-fold. Under resting state, that's this thing, this energy, the cycle is energy wasting to some degree, but this appears to be necessary in order for the maximum to be higher. The body will accept some waste if it allows for adaptability, allows for adjusting of the metabolism in a very rapid and significant way, especially with glycolysis, when you have to have lots of energy sometimes passing through, lots of carbons passing through up that pathway. Okay, in certain disease conditions, the reduction of this fetal cycle appears to have an effect on obesity. What? Obesity? Yes, with too much glucose flux, that is either this is turned off, or either the reverse is turned off or the forward is still too high. Excess carbohydrate passes through the fat pathways and converted into fat. Professor Fat. Okay. And then finally, but notice the inefficiency or some energy wasting. Now, waste energy is typically given off as what? Heat. That's precisely it. Heat. And so that provides some of this non-shivering thermogenesis necessary for animals to be warm during inactivity. Are you warm or relatively warm? Yeah, you are. So there are. This is occurring in virtually every cell in your body, that you lose some efficiency going through this cycle, and you are warm because of it. The loss of the fetal cycle, I love this. They have knockout mice, which knocks out the phosphatase. So these mice are obese, and yet they die at 25 degrees Celsius from the cold. They have no ability to withstand even a little cold, because there's without that phosphatase, you don't have that inefficiency, and you're not producing enough heat to keep you warm. At least these mice aren't. So they're fat mice that are dying from hypothermia. Fascinating stuff, ladies and gentlemen. What is this called now? What's this thing called? Fetal cycle. What's the formal name for it? For regulation. Thank you very much. All right, let's go ahead to the next one. Other carbohydrates, ladies and gentlemen. Do you eat other carbohydrates besides glucose? Oh, absolutely. And we love it. So we have galactose. Notice where galactose comes in. Where does it come in? Mannose, where does it come in? Fructose in the muscle, where does it come in? Fructose in the liver, where does it come in? Really, Dr. Novak? Seriously? Yeah. So here you go. So the fructose has different fates depending on the tissue that it's in. Muscle tissue gets shunted by hexokinase right into fructose 6-phosphate, goes on to glycolysis, gets made into energy, no big hairy deal. What's the deal with high fructose corn syrup? I mean, I don't understand this. What's on the web about high fructose corn syrup? People are, I mean, apparently there's some bad vibes on the web about fructose, high fructose corn syrup, and because, I mean, there are ads on the high fructose corn syrup makers are producing ads where they're trying to change the name from high fructose corn syrup to corn sugar. And pop manufacturers are now claiming that rather than using high fructose corn syrup, they're using real sugar. I mean, have you heard this? Have you seen this? I haven't investigated enough to know, but apparently somebody has said that high fructose corn syrup is bad for you. And so enough people have said that and are trying to get some marketing advantage, and so they're changing over to sugar. But sugar, of course, is a much more expensive sweetener in the United States because we have such a high tariff on it. At any rate. But now you know that there are two fates for fructose in your body, depending on the tissue. The first fate of fructose in your body is if it's going to the muscle, it gets converted into what? Glycolysis. And there we know exactly what happens in glycolysis. But notice what happens in the liver, ladies and gentlemen. Notice what happens in the liver. Gets made not into fructose 6, but there's a particular enzyme called fructokinase, gets made into fructose 1-phosphate. That forms an open chain form. There's an aldolase called fructose 1-phosphate aldolase. That's different than the other aldolase that's in glycolysis. That breaks it down to form glyceraldehyde, and under the influence of alcohol dehydrogenase, really? Liver alcohol dehydrogenase? You mean there's a different purpose of it than to handle alcohol? Well, apparently so. It changes into glycerol. Now, guess where glycerol goes? Think back, ladies and gentlemen, into the days of yore. We were, what? Fat! That's exactly correct. So this is where you get the three carbon backbone for fat. Okay? What happens if you eat a lot of fat and you digest it because you're in good trim condition and you're not gaining weight but you're eating fat? All right? You just got up on a Sabbath morning, you did a mile and a half jog, and then you had a little breakfast and you went to church and Sabbath school, came home, had a big old lasagna meal. Yes! And you got a big old bolus of cheese and fat in your stomach, and there's all this glycerol that's being digested and produced and absorbed. And guess where it goes? Into there. This is assuming it's using it for energy. And then from there, it goes into glyceraldehyde, and then it gets kinased, and then it goes glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate gets made into glycolysis so that you can take that afternoon walk by the Mishawaka River Walk. Have you guys ever been to the Mishawaka River Walk? You need to go to the Mishawaka River Walk. Google it. It's about a 45-minute drive. It's beautiful. Bridges, the St. Joe River, a beautiful walkway. It's about 2 miles. Okay? And there's a beautiful outside sculpture garden and some fountain waterfall kind of thing. Oh, it's gorgeous. It's really very nice. If it's a beautiful day, Google it and go. I'll give you the address if you ask me. Okay? It's a great afternoon activity. Okay, so you do that. And so that's where this liver, the glycerol comes in and leaves, okay, at this point. And then you have a variety of things that you can also do this with that all ends up being in glycerol 3-phosphate. Now, what do you need to know out of this? First of all, I want you to know where in the world these other monosaccharides enter into the glycolytic pathway. You're liable to see this on a test in which I give you that diagram and I blank out these things and you tell me where they go. The monosaccharides right here, it's also a good kind of question for a multiple choice question. Right? Then I want you to be able to say in some sort of rational form, what is the fate of glucose, fructose in the body? And you have to say it depends. If it goes to the muscle, it gets used in glycolysis. If it goes to the liver, it also can go to glycolysis, but also interrelates with fat production and fat biosynthesis. You mean if you eat a lot of fructose, you might get fat? If you eat a lot of anything, you're going to get fat. If you eat excess of anything, if you eat an excess of tofu, you can get fat. All right? What happens? How do you get fat, ladies and gentlemen? How do you get fat? More calories than used. Does it matter where the calories come from? Now, you can be malnourished and lose weight. Sure. But, sorry, it's simple physics. All right, now, galactose. Galactose. How do you get galactose where it goes? I love this because I love the names of these enzymes that are in this. You have galactose. There's a specific enzyme in the liver called galactokinase. It gets made into galactose 1-phosphate. Now, that galactose 1-phosphate exchanges itself with an enzyme, with a small molecule called UDP glucose. UDP glucose? Yeah, UDP glucose. So what happens is that galactose and the DUDB glucose exchange partners. So you release the glucose as glucose 1-phosphate, and that UDP then attaches to galactose to make UDP galactose. UDP galactose. Well, that doesn't help anything, Dr. Novak. There's still no metabolic mechanism for that. But notice the cool enzyme right here. UDP galactose 4-epimerase. I love the way they say the word epimerase. Can you say epimerase? Oh, you're very kind. Thank you for humoring an old man. Epimerase. What do you think an epimerase does? Epimer. So, exactly, it creates an epimer. What carbon is it shifting? What hydroxy group around? What carbon is it shifting? What is it? Carbon 4. That's the only thing. Exactly right. See, that's why they call it a 4-epimerase. If it was carbon number 3, they'd call it a what? 3-epimerase. Oh, these biochemists are geniuses at naming things, aren't we? At any rate, so if you change that around carbon number 4, it changes the galactose into a what? You change the hydroxy orientation in three-dimensional space at carbon number 4, galactose gets changed into glucose, and they exchange it, and you release glucose 1-phosphate. Phosphoglucomutase then changes into glucose 6-phosphate, and guess where that goes? Glycolysis. By the way, what disaccharide do you have to consume in order to get galactose? Nope. What disaccharide do you have to consume in order to get galactose? Lactose. Did you say lactose?
No.
Oh, okay, I just want to make sure. Lactose. Does this process have anything to do with lactose intolerance? No. Lactose intolerance occurs in the digestive tract. This is occurring where? You can probably pretty much say it's occurring everywhere, but it's occurring primarily in the liver. In the liver. What happens with mannose, ladies and gentlemen? Mannose gets phosphorylated hexokinase. Mannose 6 then gets phosphomannose isomerase and changes mannose 6 into fructose 6, and off you go. You're down glycolysis. So that's where the fates are going, ladies and gentlemen. Pentose phosphate pathway, also called, when I was growing up as a little boy in college, hexose monophosphate shunt. Amazing. So, hexose is the first blank, shunt is the next blank, NADPH is the third blank, riboses is the fourth blank, cannot is the fifth blank, the sixth, seventh, and eighth blank are liver, adipose tissue, and adrenal cortex. And the last blank is two stages. So let me review that. First blank is hexose. Second blank is shunt. Third blank is NADPH. And the fourth blank is riboses. Fifth blank, cannot. Sixth, liver. Seventh, adipose. Eighth, adrenal. Ninth, two stages. What is the purpose of hexose monophosphate shunt, ladies and gentlemen? also known in modern parlance as Pentecostal. What's the purpose of it? And if you want to make something in the body, you need to reduce it. You get the reducing power for making stuff from NADPH. NADPH is almost the exclusive source for reducing power for biosynthetic reactions in the body. There are diseases that occur in the red blood cell, which we'll see in a little bit, that come from the lack of production of NADPH because it's not reducing peroxides. But we'll talk about that later. At any rate, so are ribosomes important? Of course they are. NADH cannot substitute for NADPH anywhere. There are some exceptions in which the reaction is so crucial that if it didn't occur, the body would die, and that does allow for the substitution of NADH. Specifically, you'll see this when we get to the urea cycle. If you noted when you memorized the urea cycle, I didn't have you memorize all of it. At the very beginning of the urea cycle, you'll see where there's a reduction of amine group into ammonia, and the ammonia then is captured by the urea cycle. At that point, reduction power is required, and that particular enzyme that does that has either NADPH or NADH as a substrate, because it was so important for that to happen. All right, so found mainly in the liver, mammary gland. Why do you think in the mammary gland? Why do you think there's a lot of pentose phosphate pathway in the mammary gland? What's the law? This is perfectly obvious. What is it? Because you make stuff in the mammary gland. Okay, you make food in the mammary gland. Adipose tissue, why do you think there's a lot in the adipose tissue? In case you accidentally decide to, over the long term, eat too many calories. Do you know? You ever seen these little saltine crackers? This little thing? Yeah. You eat one of those day, one a day, for 365 days. You eat one of those a day more than you burn off, and that's a pound of fat. It's terrible. It's terrible. It is so easy to be overweight in the United States today. Is that a disease? Now there are some people who have psychological problems that are elicited as obesity, but I don't think it's quite the horrible thing that people say it is. Okay, it's a good thing to have actually. All right, adipose tissue, adrenal cortex. Here's the overall reaction: 3 glucoses, 6 NADPHs make 6 NADPHs, 6 hydrogen ions. 2 F6Ps, a gap, and 3 carbon dioxide. That's the first stage. And then this stuff gets rearranged. That's the overall reaction. That's the first one. And then here's the, makes this ribulose. Okay, so the first stage of the net. So this is the overall. It's the overall. And then you get, 3 of these, 6 of those, 3 of those, make 6 of those, 6 of those, 3 carbon dioxides, and 3 ribuloses. The 3 ribuloses then get rearranged to form 2 fructoses and a gap. So it's arbitrarily decided into 2 stages, 1 irreversible oxidation of G6P to ribose 5P, and the reversible production of ribose 5-phosphate or xylulose 5-phosphate, and reversible production of F26P and gap. I love this. I love this stuff. This enzyme mechanism is just when you've had organic, do you understand the nature of this reaction? Yes.
What causes
there is a genetic component to it. There's also a sedentary point to it, how fit you are. If you are a high level of fitness, your base level of metabolism is simply going to be higher. I have, over the last 9 months or so, gotten in the habit of running. Before that, I would have a bagel and an orange juice, and I'd not be hungry at noon. I'd be a little hungry. But I've started running, and it decreased the fat amount in my body and increased the metabolism level of the muscle tissue that I have. And by 10 o'clock, right now, I had my bagel and orange juice, and I'm hungry already. I'll be hungry all the way till noon. So physical exercise increases the base point for metabolism, but there's also a genetic component to it, too. Having said that, however, so there is some level of... I could lay down next to my wife, and she go, "Oh, you are just so hot. Just stay away from me. You're just... I mean, how come you're just..." And I've just been walking around. Okay. I have never felt her hot compared to me. She just has a slightly lower metabolism. She also is very careful about what she eats. Very disciplined what she eats. And she probably she hasn't gained weight in 10 or 15 years. Go figure. I don't know. So there's a genetic component and activity component to it. Yeah, there is some unfairness to it. But the bottom line is, when someone comes to you and says, you know, I eat one orange and a bagel a day and I still gain weight, they either have a very serious disease condition, of which I don't know the name of, or they're cheating. Okay. Or they're not doing anything. They're literally comatose in bed. Okay. You just, yeah. So there's a wide variety of things. There's a lot, but it's primarily, if you ask the question, it is primarily there's a set point that you can establish based on your activity level, and there's a genetic component to it. Well, there has to be. I mean, look at women. Women are designed by God to have more fat tissue than men. Okay? Hallelujah for that. Okay? So there's a purpose for that fat. At any rate, so yeah, it's a good question. No good answers for it. There's no easy way around it. If you want to lose weight, you gotta feel starvation. That's all. Gotta be hungry. What? I mean, am I wrong? No. There's no easy way. You can ameliorate some of the hunger pangs by taking certain drugs and amphetamines. Some doctors will provide a diet pill, and the amphetamines increase your metabolic rate and also suppress your appetite so you don't feel it as much. But you still, you know, that's helpful, but it's a crutch. When you knock the crutch out from underneath you, you go back to your old habits. At any rate, so it's a great question. We'll talk more about that ongoing. All right, so let's go ahead. Now, notice here, if you would, I don't know if you can see this, but there are actually three lines here, and three lines there, and three here, and there are three lines coming off this thing. So what do you think the idea is that in this graph there are three lines right there? What does that indicate? Yeah, three of the units. Let's take a look at that. Now, if there are three glucoses that start this, how many carbons total is that? 18. So 18 carbons. We go through, the very first thing we do is we reduce it to make NADPH. Yay! You get this glucose, 6-phosphoglucose-lactone, alpha-lactone. And then you have the 6-phosphogluconase, lactonase. I'm not going to include it. And make this stuff. You lose water, oxidize that. Then you have an opportunity to lose some carbon dioxide. Now, how many carbon dioxides are you losing if you have three of these there? How many are you losing? It says one here, but actually there are three lines. So how many carbon dioxides are you losing? Three. So let's take a look at this. From here, you start off with 3-glucose-6-phosphates, and you end up with 3-ribulose-5-phosphates. You make 6 NADPHs here, 6 NADPHs here, not 6. You make three here and three here for a total of six, and you lose three carbon dioxides. So let's do an accounting of all the carbons. How many carbons did you begin with? 18. How many carbons did you end up with right here in the sugars? 15. And how many carbons did you lose? 3. Did that add up to 18? Yeah. That's called the oxidative portion. Notice the arrows are what? Only one way. It's irreversible. Once a glucose 6-phosphate is committed to this step, it doesn't go back, not least through this pathway. So we make ribulose 5-phosphate. And how many of them do we have? 3. Okay. So we have 3 5s. And at the end of this process, that's how many carbons? 15. At the end of this process, which is being hidden by my notice of the STEMS chairs meeting. Yes, think, think. We end up with 1, 2, 3. Okay, how many carbons in fructose? How many carbons in fructose? How many carbons in glyceraldehyde? How many carbons is that? So we get with this non-oxidative reversible portion changes 3 5s into 2 6s and a... Where do you think they go? Where do you think fructose 6-phosphate could go? Where do you think glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate could go? Glycolysis. Now, what if you needed to make ribulose 5-phosphate for DNA RNA synthesis, but you didn't need any NADPH? Can you take two fructoses and a glyceraldehyde and make them into 3 ribuloses? Say yes. This process is reversible. Notice these double-headed arrows are not by accident. They actually occur. Notice what happens. So there's an enzyme called ribulose 5-phosphate isomerase, changes this 5-carbon unit into a ribose. Then there's an epimerase that changes these two into 2 xyloses. 2 xyloses. So then this 5 and this 2 combine using a trans what? Ketolase to make a what sugar? Acetohepatiolase is how many? 7. So a 5 and a 2 make a 7, leaving a what? If 2 came off this 5, what's left here? A 3. So now over here you have a 7 and a 3. The 7 and 3 is how many? 10. A transaldolase. A transaldolase. Notice here. So you got that glyceraldehyde. Notice here it's 10. That 10 gets rearranged by a transaldolase to make a what? A 6 and a 4. All right. A 4 and a 5 is a what? 9. So that 4 and 5 make a 9, which then gets regenerated by that same transketolase to make a 6 and a 3. Let's figure this out. Let's see.
I don't understand how you have 4 and 6 and then you have 6 and 3.
Yeah. I'm not sure exactly where you are, but notice this bottom line here, right here. This is 5. Actually, no, this is a 5. Did I say 6?
On the left side.
I did say 6. This is, xylose is how many carbons? Over here?
Yeah, there's 6 and 4, and then you go over to the right, and now there's...
Right. Now, that you have, what happens is that 6 is peeled off. It's not being used. It's done. When it gets to fructose, it's done. I'm taking merely this 4 here and this 5 here to make... So there's this 5 and this 4 make a total of 9, which then gets split up into a 6 and a 3. Fascinating, isn't it? I mean, it's fascinating to me. You can go ahead. Let's run through this again. How many? There are a total of 15 carbons right here. 5 and a 2 make a 7 with a remainder of a what? A 3, which makes that glyceraldehyde. That 7 and a 3 then go to make under the transaldolase, make a 6 and a 4. Then the 6 is done. That 4 and the second 5 make a 9 to convert it into a 3 and a 6. And that's the non-oxidative reductive form. Notice how many carbon bonds are broken and reformed here. How much energy do they use for this? There's not a single ATP used in this for all that carbon breaking and reforming. It's amazing. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Have a great weekend. We'll see you on Monday. The reading guide is due on Monday. Okay.